I think one of the things people don't realize is that your brain has no chance. Facebook is a 10 million computer. There are 10 million computers and data centers around the world that run Google and run Facebook. I think Google is actually 100 million computers now. And your one brain has no chance against these mega computers that are like incredibly smart. The dream has always been this utopia where everybody can publish and everybody can find a community. You can find the 1,000 people that are into what you're into. But the problem is, up until this point, we haven't discovered a business model that's not advertising.
Welcome to the Dandelion Effect Podcast, a space for organic conversation about the magic of living a connected life. Just like the natural world around us, we are all linked through an intricate web, a never-ending ripple that spans across the globe. Here, we explore the ideas that our guests carry through the world, remember who and what inspired them along the way, and uncover the seeds that help them blossom into their unique version of this human experience. This podcast is a production of the Feather Pipe Foundation, whose mission is to help people find their direction through access to programs and experiences that support healing, education, community, and empowerment. Have you ever wondered how we even got here to the digital age of information overload, where it's commonplace to check your phone hundreds of times per day, receive your news, email, laughs, and all communications on this tiny device that's turning your hand into a lobster claw and keeping chiropractors in business? Well, today we'll get some insight into the evolution of the internet and the ways it has woven into our lives as we know it. I'm talking with Dave Morin, who is an entrepreneur, investor, and philanthropist born and raised in Helena, Montana. Currently, he is co-founder of Offline Ventures, an investing and inventing company focused on the creation of humanist technology and serving founder potential. He's also chairman of Esalen Institute, a leading center for exploring and realizing human potential through experience, education, and research. Early in his career, Dave was the 29th employee at Facebook, and his first job upon moving to San Francisco was at Apple. Needless to say, he's been on the forefront of tech innovation since the start of the internet in the 90s, and over the last couple decades has co-founded and managed a handful of ventures in this realm. Path, a company dedicated to being a source of happiness, meaning, and connection through simplicity and privacy and social networking. Slow Ventures, a Silicon Valley venture fund that champions long-term thinking and serves a community of over 300 of the most innovative startups in the world. And Sunrise, a nonprofit focused on bringing together science, spirituality, technology, and design to revolutionize how humans experience depression. In today's conversation, we talk about his path from a ski racer in small town Montana to an angel investor and serial entrepreneur smack in the middle of the tech capital of the country, Silicon Valley, California. Recognizing early on that his brain was different than most other kids, Dave describes his childhood as one of looking for belonging, and he found solace and stimulation at his grandfather's house while playing on one of the earliest computer models. He was also serendipitously introduced to a Japanese martial art through his best friend's uncle, and that began his lifelong foray into Eastern philosophy, self-awareness, and contemplative practices. We tackle a big topic today in our conversation, mental health in the age of technology. And while this interview just barely scratches the surface of the immensity of this topic, I hope you walk away with an understanding of the nuance of our current predicament, the good and the bad of modern technology, the intent with which it was originally created, and the knowing that there are people like Dave out there pouring themselves into ideas like Web3 and how to make our interactions with these tools safer, healthier, and more human. I'm Andy Van Treese, and you're listening to the Dandelion Effect Podcast with today's guest and my new friend, Dave Morin. You know, this podcast and even the Feathered Pipe Ranch, how it operates, is really all about connections, starting with connection to self and, you know, connection to others, connection to land, connection to whatever spiritual, religious background people have, this higher power type of thing. And so I want to start where you and I have a mutual connection, and that is Montana. You grew up in Helena, where the Feather Pipe Ranch has been for the last, gosh, almost 50 years now. I want to know, especially from somebody who's now living in San Francisco and is in a very different world than Montana, I want to give you a chance to reflect on what it was like to grow up in Helena and who was Dave as a kid?
Big questions right out of the gate. Big questions for a small town guy. It's a good question to start off with, because the reason that I'm here is that I care so much about Helena and Montana more broadly. I, you know, obviously grew up there, but the connection with the Feather Pipe is especially important to me because India was like a dear friend of my family. I'm the chairman of the Esalen Institute now, which there aren't many centers that are as longstanding as Esalen and Feathered Pipe. Most of them go out of business. They don't last. And so I think Feathered Pipe is important for a bunch of reasons. It's in my hometown, and yoga and meditation, holistic health, as you said, really matter to me. And so I think being from Montana is such a special thing. It's an ethos. It's a vibe. It's in my DNA. You know, I grew up west side of town. You know, I went to Hawthorne Elementary School. And just like my mom, my grandparents actually were the ones that moved to Montana and were the reason that we ended up there. I think you're from the East Coast, right?
Right.
My grandparents, actually on both sides of the family, are from Boston. On my mom's side, originally came over on the Mayflower.
Wow.
And so we go way back to the East Coast beginnings of America. And so people frequently ask me, like, how did you end up in Montana? And my grandfather was in the 101st Airborne.
Okay.
And after he had graduated from Dartmouth, and then he went to Johns Hopkins and became a doctor, and then he ended up in the military during the war, and he was a paradoctor. When they got back from the war, they, you know, had this question of, well, what do we do with all these doctors that can jump out of airplanes? And the answer was, well, send them west, because all these people are dying in the wilderness because they're going on adventures and they get lost and, you know, climbing and hiking. And so he got shipped out west, I think first to Colorado Springs, then to South Dakota, and then ended up in Great Falls, discovered Helena and fell in love with it, and became, you know, kind of the family doc in Helena.
Oh, wow.
After the war. He was a really remarkable man and a huge influence on my life. It's like a trend line that follows from my childhood all the way through. So
I think it's really interesting how when we look back on our lives is when we can really spot those types of things. And, you know, you probably didn't know it at the time when you were young as it was happening. But if you're looking back on your young life, like, where does that trend line start? And what are some of the ways that he and other people began to shape you?
One of the things that's coming up for me is that, you know, in kindergarten, first grade, going to elementary school, I knew that my brain was different than other kids. My mom would actually later on in life tell me that my teachers would always say, like, you know, Dave's not talking about the same things that the other kids are talking about. I guess I was asking them about the world and, you know, was like concerned with the war. And like, this was like in first grade. And I also was interested in topics and concepts that were like more advanced to some extent, but had a really hard time socializing with friendships and things. And at the time, didn't really understand it. There were also things like math that were really difficult for me, you know? And so I got put in this, like, back then they called it the gifted and talented program, which was really code for kids who aren't like the other kids. Turned out that I actually have ADD. And so I think my mom had me on some medication or something for like 6 months and then decided that she didn't want that to happen anymore. And so, you know, I just wasn't on medication. She had had a son that died before I was born. He got to be 1 month old and died of a spina bifida. Mm. And so she didn't want any chemicals or anything touching me.
Yeah.
This is an important story because I think that growing up, I was looking for belonging and I always felt different than everybody else. And it can be really hard having a, you know, there's lots of different words for it these days, a neurodivergent brain, whatever you want to say. It's like it can just be hard being different. And so early on, I think by second or third grade, my grandfather was a really interesting character, particularly in the context of Montana and Helena, jumping out of airplanes to try to like save firefighters in forest fires. There's a famous book that Norman MacLean, the author of A River Runs Through It, wrote called Young Men in Fire about the Mann Gulch fire.
Wait, I think I just learned about this fire when I was on a, you know, when you can go out to Gates of the Mountain and get the boat,
That's the
you
fire.
know, and get the tour. Yeah, we just learned about this last summer.
Yeah. So my grandfather jumped out of a plane into that fire.
Oh my God.
And there's a book about it, you know. And so my grandfather was this like larger than life character. And he, you know, had grown up on the East Coast and was a ski racer growing up. And so he became the doctor for the US Olympic ski team in 1960. And then became very involved in ski racing all over the world. He was the vice president of the International Ski Federation. And so I tell you all of this to say that going into my grandfather's house in Helena was like walking into a different world
Yeah.
than anything else that you could experience, perhaps in Helena, if not, you know, most of Montana. And so because I felt so different, I would go over to his house every day after school. And he had a Macintosh computer. I was probably 6 years old. He had one of the first Macintoshes. And I would go over there every day and play with it and learn to program it and build things on it. He would watch TV and he was always watching the space shuttle. And he had a satellite dish. And he would like show me these rockets and space shuttles. And he'd be on his speakerphone, like talking to really interesting people all over the world about ski racing stuff and the Olympics. And I would sit there and, on the computer, and it was sort of facing away from him, but I'd be in the same room. And it's one of the things that I look back on that was one of the real lucks of my childhood. Though I felt very different, and that was a really deep struggle, I had this like outlet that really drew this through line to like the literally the place that I'm sitting today. I sort of sit square in the middle of Silicon Valley. Had I not been able to go over there, I don't know if that would have happened. The other thing I would say is my lifelong best friend, we were pretty much in diapers together. You know, he's a fourth or fifth generation Montana ranching family, deeply embedded in Montana ranch culture, you know, one of the largest ranches in Montana between Helena and Great Falls. And his uncle, his dad's brother, was a real cowboy, but he was a mystical cowboy. And he actually spent a ton of time at the Feathered Pipe. And then he went to Japan and became a 12th degree black belt in Aikido when we were little kids. And he came back to Helena, and right next to the Wells Fargo drive-through downtown, across from where the Real Food Store used to be, he started an Aikido dojo when we were in elementary school. He and I would go to his uncle's Aikido studio after school, and we became pretty highly ranked. You know, I think I made it to like a kid's brown belt.
Is it like a Japanese martial art?
Yeah, it's a Japanese martial art. It's more like yoga than it is like a martial art. It's not an offensive martial art. The entire concept in Aikido is to redirect the attacker's energy against them in order to just diffuse the situation and to create more optionality. There's a famous saying, take the hit as a gift. That's another through line, which I guess is important because it really gave me a understanding of meditation and Eastern spirituality and mysticism very early on in life. I mean, like elementary school, middle school, made me ask questions about traditional religion and spirituality that maybe I wouldn't have. And I think it really colored my perspective as the years have gone on. So,
And I guess around that time is probably when you got into ski racing as well, right?
being in my family with a grandfather that was like involved with running ski racing worldwide and the Olympics and stuff, it was like if you weren't competitively winning in ski racing, you like didn't get love. I really loved ski racing, There were other sports like soccer, which my dad was really into. I wasn't as good at the team stuff, which you can hear it in my voice. I still, I think, feel bad about.
You needed to be able to go off on your own.
Yeah, when you have a different type of brain, you tend to get a lot of negative feedback from authority figures. And so I gravitated towards individual sports. I was very dedicated and very serious about ski racing and took it pretty far, actually. Junior Olympic, sort of pretty high up level. I also played a lot of tennis and was quite good at it, not as good at ski racing.
You know, one of the things that I'm hearing as you talk about your grandfather's house and then talk about your friend's uncle introducing you to this form of moving meditation, learning about energy at such a young age, it also occurs to me that these are things to a young mind like yours that expanded your world. Like you have certain opportunities and certain lack of opportunities growing up in a small town. You have these characters and these people who get to introduce you to a whole different way of thinking. Even just to hear your grandfather talking to people across the world, that to me seems like possibility.
I really feel so lucky in hindsight. To your point, like you could have been conceptually just not even understanding that you could be on the phone, like talking to the head of Marker Bindings or Bollé sunglasses, or you know, my grandfather had this medal from the country of China on his wall that was like an honorary citizenship because they went over there to put ski areas in the middle of this was during the Cold War. I mean, just think about it in the context of what's going on in the world today, right? Like this notion that even during times of great tension, there are topics and things that create harmony and balance, and it's possible to be diplomatic for skiing reasons or the Olympics reasons, right? As you know, in yoga, right view, you know, I sort of was able to look broader, I think, than some folks. You know, I think that growing up in a small town in Montana, it can feel very constraining, like there's not a lot of opportunity. But even just knowing that it's possible to live in Helena and like have this influence and impact on this greater scope, I think was a really major.
You know, maybe you can hit some of the highlights of the trajectory of you being exposed to some of these things at a young age and getting into skiing and entering into the world of tech and moving west and how that all happened.
Throughout high school, I was really focused on ski racing. I would train in Mount Hood during the summers. I initially was quite good at the slalom and giant slalom, the shorter, more turns. But as time went on, I became much better at downhill, actually, the speed sports. And it was largely due to the realization that even though I wasn't the biggest, I realized pretty quickly that everyone who's setting foot into the downhill starting gate has the same skill set. You have the skills to go 70, 80 miles an hour on skis, top to bottom for 2 minutes. And so, who wins and why became this interesting question. And I really started to realize that it was about who was willing to go the fastest, not who has better skills or more weight or physiological advantages. It was actually a psychology game. That's when I started winning. And so, you know, that was a real passion. You know, at the same time, I was really passionate about computers and the internet. I was always really good with computers. And throughout, I mean, middle school and high school, I was just doing internet and computer stuff and building things on the internet. And I was like the editor of the school paper.
What years was this, Dave?
This was 97, 98.
Okay.
I was in high school between 95 or 96 and 99, which really was the beginnings of the internet. And so the whole time I'm like playing with the internet every single day, you know, after school. All I ever wanted to do is like be on these internet chat systems, like Internet Relay Chat, IRC, and AOL, and building web pages and writing HTML and messing around with JavaScript and like all this stuff that was weird tech stuff. By my senior year, my dad actually at the time worked at the state of Montana. And he had like called into the help desk to get help with his computer one day. And he just randomly asked them if they had needed like smart computer people. And so I get a call from the state of Montana my junior year of high school, and I was still working at this shoe store in the mall. And they were like, "Hey kid, like we hear you're really good with computers, do you want to come in and interview to like work at the state?" And so I get a job, and I think all my friends were making like $5 an hour or whatever the minimum wage was back then. I know it was like five or 5:15 or something. I get hired in the, information technology division. So here I am making $10 an hour now, only kid in senior year of high school that's carrying a pager. Everybody thought I was a drug dealer,
Oh my
which
gosh.
couldn't have been further from the truth because I was like this hardcore ski racer who, never touched alcohol or drugs, period, because I was so in love with ski racing and didn't want to, ever get kicked out of doing that. So
Wow.
anyway, so that kind of takes you up to leaving high school. I was deeply a small town kid that I think was kind of not sure about leaving.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. I always wanted to leave. I always wanted to get out. If you were interviewing, I think some of my friends from high school, they would say that like I was always saying that I was going to go out and try to change the world. Or
Yeah.
I remember being very scared to leave Montana
Of course.
after visiting Boulder. I just fell in love with the campus and the beauty of the mountains in Boulder. And it was really expensive. Nobody from Helena could afford to go to any of these places. And my grandfather actually was the one that offered to not pay for it all, but give me enough that I could have a job and pay my share of my tuition. And then he would help me cover the rest. So I was able to, leave the state. So I chose Boulder. And in hindsight, I think the thing I didn't realize was how big it was. There are more students at Boulder than the whole population of Helena.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Legitimately freaked out. Kind of went into this like pretty extreme anxiety, depression sort of state when I went to Boulder, to the point where I was like begging my parents to let me come home. Ultimately made it through that, but I think back on it as like a traumatic time almost. I guess this brings me to the pinnacle of your question. Where did the intersection with tech truly start? Well, my freshman year, I had worked at the state of Montana the whole summer. And I remember I had saved up $1,000 total in order to pay for my like everything for like the first, I was like my spending money outside of like tuition and stuff. And I was planning to ski race for Boulder. And I remember I went to the first meeting and they like detailed the costs. And it was going to be more than I had saved. And this was 99 when I went to college. And the internet was like really starting to take off in the fall of 99. I think I had already started doing website projects for people, but it hadn't really fully gotten going. But I was sitting there in this meeting for the ski team. And I was like, there's no way. Like, I'm not going to spend all my money on this. And I had this kind of, in hindsight, I'm not sure how I even had this awareness, but it was like this, well, I could be a ski racer and not really have a career, or I could have a career. I remember I have this very distinct memory of being like, I think that there's something in this internet website building stuff that I'm doing.
That's a heck of an insight for a 18, 19-year-old to have as a freshman in college to foresee something like the internet getting big.
I got pretty serious about trying to create a little business right after that. And the other thing that happened that year was that my grandfather had a heart attack and he had triple bypass surgery, ended up in a coma, and his whole estate was frozen. And I lost all my funding for college.
Oh, wow.
Here I am. I'm like a fish out of water. I've never seen a city as big as Denver before, which in hindsight is kind of hilarious.
Just knowing where you are now and where you've been.
Like, I've done business in like Jakarta or like Shanghai. These are like 30 million person cities. Like, I was like really freaked out by Denver. Okay. And so here I am. How am I going to pay? I think tuition was 25,000 for a Montanan. Like, maybe this won't resonate with people who are listening who aren't from Montana, but I mean, most of my friends that stayed in state were planning to spend four for all of college. Right. So I'm like, how? I knew nothing about entrepreneurship. I didn't know what sole proprietorship was or an LLC or this stuff was not as easy to learn as it is today. Like you couldn't go on a website and like set up an LLC. And so I started to take it more seriously. And I made a website and people started calling my dorm room asking if I'd build them a website. And I had this idea, which was everybody was buying domain names back then. And so I started calling these companies that sold domain names and asking them if they would refer people who bought domain names to me after they bought a domain name so that I could build their website.
Good idea.
I would get like these, you know, emails like almost every day of an introduction to somebody who'd bought a domain and, you know, needs their website built for their business. And this was before anybody had businesses or websites for their business, right? And so I was kind of building different types of websites for different types of businesses. Sometimes it was just basically what you would today call graphic design with some buttons. And then sometimes it was like a, oh, we're a shipping company and we have a database and we want to like be able to track our packages. It's like funny to even say in hindsight, right?
And you're just figuring out how to do this by yourself.
Yeah, I was teaching myself. Back to the through lines. I was in first grade, this kid with ADD who was largely told you're doing it wrong. And so I didn't realize it at the time, but now what I realize is that I taught myself how to teach myself things because I had a hard time communicating with teachers and coaches, and I'm going to forget things and I'm going to, you know, not show up on time or maybe forget to show up at all. Like there's all these things that the executive functions of this type of brain really upsets people. And so I learned how to learn things, which was really valuable. And so I taught myself a lot about the internet, and very quickly started happening was, you know, I had these people like calling my dorm room that needed a website after they bought their domain. And they're like, I'll pay you $1,000 to build a website. And then I could do the work to build the website in a weekend.
Yeah.
And so sometimes they'd pay 2,000, sometimes they'd pay 10 if it was a database. And so I started doing databases and I'm making $10,000. And I think that first year I made $100,000 building websites.
That's amazing.
And so I was able to pay for college. I bought a car with cash, literally walked in and wrote a check, which is like not something a small town Helena kid can do.
Was it exciting to you at this point? I'm thinking kind of back to just the world opening up.
It was more empowering. I very quickly started to realize that, you know, like the movie, The Matrix, it's like when you see the code, that's kind of what happened. It was like, oh, for example, something I didn't know, but when you're an entrepreneur and you build a new business and you buy equipment for that business, you can expense that. It counts, you know, against your taxes. All these things become tax deductible. And so I'm able to buy really sophisticated computer equipment and I have a cell phone. My freshman year in college, everybody had dorm room phones, which is really funny to even say. It's like when you met someone, you got their number, you call their dorm room and they had to like be in the room when you know.
Yeah.
I had a Motorola StarTAC and everybody thought that was like futuristic and crazy. But again, all of these things are business expenses. And it was like I'd figured out this thing about the world, which I wasn't told. I think when you grow up in a small town, it's like just get the job and work hard. You know, do what you're told. Nobody ever told me that I could start my own business, that I could be the author of my own life.
Yeah.
And so went from sort of being kind of, I don't understand, to this is like my path and absolute freedom.
Yeah.
And I'm never doing anything else. I remember telling people in college, like, I will always be an entrepreneur. There's nothing you could pay me to go back to the other way. And you know, it meant some things, right? There are sacrifices. Like I didn't get to do a year studying abroad. I didn't get to do a lot of things that other kids did in college because I had clients that were calling me. I'd like walk out of class because like, I remember I had a client in Brooklyn that called me the Brooklyn accent and I'd have to leave class and like flip my phone open, right? And people would just look at me funny, right?
Yeah, like what is this guy doing? It's so, like you said, it's so futuristic, but the word empowering really seems to fit because it's like you got to make your own rules in a world that was changing really quickly. That led to a lot of opportunity and there was a lot of room to pave that new path.
entrepreneurship is the rest of the story. And it still is to this day. My greatest passion is the power of ideas and entrepreneurship. Mm-hmm. It's like yoga. It's come as a practice. Like the more I've worked on entrepreneurship, which to me is the process of manifesting ideas into the world, the more passionate that I am about helping people do it. Life's only short once. And are you going to write your own story? Or is somebody else going to write it? Mm-hmm. I always tell people things like email is other people's to-do list for your life. Are you going to just respond to what's coming to you? Whether it's the classes that your parents chose or, you know, the school or the job or whatever other people have told you, or are you going to be on offense? For me, entrepreneurship, it's this extraordinary blank canvas, and that can be very anxiety inducing for many, but it was the most important discovery of my life.
That's a pretty good segue into some of the topics of technology that I want to cover.
Yeah.
I listened to a couple other interviews that you did talking about ways to interact with technology and have more of a balanced approach, whether it's social media, whether it's email, whether it's the endless number of apps that we use within our companies and within our lives. I want to start that conversation around how to interact and engage with technology in a more balanced way that serves us rather than us serving it.
Yeah.
Where are you with this conversation now, and how would you lead us into like what you're working on in that world?
After I left college, I decided to move to California. I didn't have a job. I had a friend that was from Marin County, north of San Francisco. And she kept telling me that this is your destiny. This is where you belong. They always nicknamed me Dave.com in college.
Oh, that's good.
She's like, you're moving to Silicon Valley. It's like the only option for you. And I had never considered it, literally.
Did you know it existed?
This is what's really funny, okay? You grew up in Montana, and as you know, there are literally people with bumper stickers that have the sign for hunting season on the bumper sticker. And then it says open season. And then you know how you can like put the wood thing for like what's in season? And it says Californians, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So California was quite literally never a dream. I never once thought about living here. In fact, I think I was incredibly biased against living here.
I'm sure.
But I really did love the internet. And all you hear about was San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
I had another friend who grew up here and was moving out. I will never forget coming out here the first time to visit, driving from SFO into San Francisco for the first time.
What did it feel like?
I remember two things. One, oh my God, this is the biggest city I've ever seen. And number two, this is beautiful. But the buildings here are like pastels, cream and pink, and they're almost art deco in a way. And so I moved out here. I had one goal or one intuition, which was I loved Apple ever since my grandfather's room growing up. And Steve Jobs was back at Apple, and I'd known a couple people there. But the dot-com crash had just happened when I graduated college. The economy was in a terrible recession. I thought that I'd move out here and keep making websites. But the business had really dried up. People didn't want websites.
Mm-hmm.
I was putting my like business on Craigslist, and it just, you know, it was like very hard to find work writing software, which is hilarious in hindsight. And I decided to start taking some of my friends that I knew that worked at Apple out to lunch and telling them what I thought Apple should do with their strategy. For about 6 months, I had no work. Like I was just living off of my savings and trying to figure it out. I had another one of these like terrifying, like several multiples of the fear over the Boulder thing.
Yeah.
And for 6 months, I'm like, what am I going to do? And I tell this story to get into answering your question, because I got really lucky. I took these friends to Apple, and they finally were like, you need to come and interview. And so in the October of that year, I did 14 interviews in one day. And
what?
At the end of the day, they offered me a job.
Wow.
So I got this job at Apple, and I got to work with Steve Jobs, and Steve would tell this story about the personal computer, which was that when you look at the human, in comparison to all the other animals in the animal kingdom. And if you stack rank all of the animals on locomotion, so like how fast, how efficient is that animal at moving through space?
Mm-hmm.
Humans are like somewhere in the middle of the stack. And it's like the eagle and the cheetah are like number one, unless you put a human on a bicycle. And a human on a bicycle becomes number one immediately. What you learn from this is that humans are tool builders. And the computer was, Steve would say, the bicycle for the mind. The vision for computers was one of human potential, that computers are a potential enhancing, a creativity enhancing tool.
Mm-hmm.
They're tools. That's why I loved building things on the internet. So I love computers my whole life. You know, these were tools for authoring communities and connection and new worlds. And, you know, I worked at Apple for several years and then I decided to go work at Facebook. And I was very early at Facebook, 29th employee. When I went there, we often thought of it as not the bicycle for the mind, but we thought of what we were doing as another tool that dramatically expanded human potential.
Mm-hmm.
Because the human brain is constrained in the number of stable relationships that it can maintain. You know, famously Dunbar's number of 150 mm-hmm. is the maximum number of stable relationships the human brain can maintain. And our thought was that by giving people this powerful social networking technology, that it would empower community and connection and people to have voice in ways that never existed before. It's hard to even put yourself back in time to 2005, when all of the songs you listened to, the shows you watched, everything was controlled by the newspaper, the radio station, the NBC, the ABC. All of the things that you consumed were mass media edited and controlled by someone else or a very small room of people. It was very hard to start up a podcast like we're doing right now.
Yeah, it is hard to think back to that because it's so different.
Yeah, and even before I left Apple, I actually worked on the podcast product, and it was largely came out of people trying to use web publishing technology and some of these new protocols, this one protocol called RSS, which there was a bunch of debates around, could you embed audio files in this RSS thing? And we had been working on iPods at Apple. And the notion was, if you could structure a playlist in a sequence and then enable people to subscribe to a playlist, you could effectively create a democratized radio
mm-hmm.
where anybody could have a radio show. And at the time, people thought this was crazy. And, you know, we would go to these meetups in the city where, like, people were talking about the RSS spec and, like, how to do it technically. And I would come back and, like, draw this stuff on whiteboards. Ultimately, we added a podcasting thing to the iTunes store. And, like, everything in that time period was focused on empowering the individual, first with the computer, to have, you know, the ability to publish their own documents and websites and videos. If you remember, it was like iPhoto and iMovie and
mm-hmm.
you know, all these creative tools for creating digital content. And then the next phase was taking that stuff you created with the computer and then broadcasting it onto this new internet.
Yeah.
The web made it possible for anyone to publish and to gain an audience. And it was really exciting and really empowering. I mean, it was intoxicating almost how empowering it felt to be giving people these powerful tools for, you know, storytelling and narrative and developing their own audience.
It's really interesting to hear that, what it felt like when you were building these tools and the intent when you first started at Facebook and some of these other platforms that have just gotten so huge and are at the center of this almost battle, if you want to say, battle for attention, battle for focus and consciousness, like you mentioned in the beginning. So I appreciate you bringing in that narrative and just laying it out.
That's where this all came from. And I think it's important to start there because I think it's important to understand intent, the problems that we can get into with how to think about using technology and integrating technology in a more balanced, healthy life are problems which were maybe foreseeable, but I don't know. I think about this all the time. It's very hard to go back. And we were sitting there in 2006 and we had 15 million college students or 10 million college students using Facebook. It's just impossible to put your mind into what does the world look like when 2 billion people are using it, and every culture in the world, every single individual human can pick up their phone and have a million person audience with a tweet.
Yeah.
You know, like that's just, you can't project what culture would be like. Even watching what just happened with this war in Ukraine and how big of an impact social media has had. I don't even think a week beforehand I would have predicted some of the things that happened, right?
Right.
Some of the things that we deal with now are hard and they're not easy. They're very nuanced, and figuring out what to do and how to live in the modern world is very difficult with technology. And I think my overarching point of view is balance is the goal.
Yeah.
I am not a fundamentalist in really any way, but I think that with technology in 2022, whether it's your own individual use or your, if you're a parent or a serious yogi or whatever, it's very hard to cold turkey it, let's say, you know? And so then the question is like the right balance.
You know, I think about this topic mirroring a lot of other topics and the ways that people react to the potential solutions. I mean, you have those people who are going to be dogmatic on both sides or fundamentalist saying we need to get rid of it altogether. Or there's other people who will just say, well, let's go on a retreat. Like, you know, we have a retreat at the Feather Pipe Ranch called the Mindful Unplugged, where it's all about how do we engage with it differently. And, you know, could we do digital detoxes throughout the year? And then you have people who are able to engage with it in more healthful ways and build their own boundaries. And then you have people where it's like totally addictive and they do need to have parameters set for them. So I understand that nuance and I understand that there's not one answer. In my mind, there's never one answer to any big issue or big challenge.
There's so many levels to this problem. I worry a lot about the Twitterization of consciousness. The more time that you spend in yoga practice or meditation practice, the more you realize the power of sustained focus and non-dual, non-reactive, non-judgment, the ability to notice the feelings that arise from either your own internal narratives and dialogues and monkey brain, or the interactions that you have with others, and the ability to pause and react intentionally, or not react at all, but experience the experience or the emotion or the whatever arises based on what's happening in this moment. And then make an intentional choice as to what the next action is. And I worry quite a bit that a lot of the world is experiencing the world through technology in a reactive way. Because what's happened is that social media in particular has really become quite good at getting people involved in systems. It's not just like any individual piece of content, but it's like the way that the system encourages you to respond to very short pieces of text or photos, which generally are most effective when they cause a emotional reaction or some kind of reactive response in your physiology. And so what you have is like a stream of reaction-based interactions. And there are these deeply human things, right? A lot of people don't think about this, but if you study belief and belief systems, and why do some people believe in the Republican ideology or the Democrat ideology, or why is somebody Christian? Why is somebody Buddhist? Why is somebody Jewish? Whatever. What people don't think about is that many ideologies, whether they're political, social, spiritual, they're information technologies. They help you make sense of the world. They help you have a personal belief system, which enables you to interact with social structures around you to understand what to expect. And what social media has done is people think that they are Buddhist, or they think that they are this or that, but actually they are the sum composite of having experienced a lot of these different philosophies through the internet. And I almost think of everyone as their own little walking subculture. Mm. Like everybody's their own combo of all of the things.
Yeah.
And it's very deeply human to, if you feel discluded from a group, you tend to take the opposite side. This is very well studied, that when somebody, you know, decides to be in this religion or that religion or this ideology or that, if they feel as though the group that is the in-group is discluding them, or that they no longer belong, they tend to aggressively adopt the opposing viewpoint or the opposing set of values. And this is super well studied. And I think that the internet is like extremely good at doing this on a micro level all day, every day.
Yeah.
You take that and fill it also with a lot of reactionary text and words and things that aren't totally factual and kind of are mostly rooted in emotion and the desire to belong, but also driven by the feeling of not belonging.
Mm-hmm.
And you end up with this like really confusing, exhausting collective consciousness. And to me, that's like what Twitter is.
Yeah.
As a person, focus on mindfulness or mental wellness in any form, this can be exhausting. How do you engage with this stuff? You've got a business, or you're trying to build it. You're a yogi and you've got a sangha and you want to engage everyone, or you're Feathered Pipe Ranch and you want to stay engaged with people. Do I have to use this stuff? Like, do I want to be out there in this world? Well, it does seem to give me a voice, but it seems really exhausting. And my joke is that everybody talks about the metaverse like it's this thing that doesn't exist.
Yeah.
I think the metaverse does exist, and it's called Zoom and Instagram. We're already in it. Like, we're all already like staring at screens all day instead of being in nature. And there's some good. It's kind of cool that we can do what we're doing right now.
Yeah.
But being on Zoom from 8 to 5 every day, probably not healthy. But a lot of people I know are doing that right now.
So what you just laid out was pretty clear as to why people have the mental challenges that they have and that we have. Feelings of FOMO, you know, the fear of missing out, the comparisons, which is something I talked about in the last episode with Vijay, the ways that you find yourself able to belong, but then there's also this really underlying feeling of not belonging in a lot of other groups and spaces on the internet. What are the things that the tech industry can be doing better, and how can they be serving us in a more healthful way?
Maybe to think about the future for a minute, like, you could argue that computing needs to evolve, because we are using very primitive interfaces for computing, and in particular for collaborating through computers. Like, you and I are sitting here, you've got headphones on, I've got a microphone in front of my face, I've got like a camera mounted above my monitor. This is very inhumane. Yeah. What we're doing right now, it's like all like compositive, like tech, some old, some new.
Right.
None of it's very human. I'm still using a keyboard and a mouse to talk to the computer. Steve Jobs used to say that all of the value at Apple was created by three things: the keyboard and the mouse, the click wheel on the iPod, and the multi-touch interface. And all of those things are the human interface with the computer. One of the things we need to be demanding from the world and from our technology companies is more humane technology, more humane interfaces. We can all do the best that we can. We can go learn meditation. You can use those skills to moderate, whether you're on Zoom all day, whether you're picking up your phone too much. We can look at the tech companies and say, like, are they putting tools into the phones that help us manage screen time? Well, yes, they are, but I'm a parent and I really would like to put limits on my kids' ability to use their iPads and things. I don't mind that they play education games and watch some shows each day, but it's actually quite hard to get an iPad to shut down.
Yeah, and I think about how many times a day I ignore the time limit that I have set for myself on Instagram or on screen time. It's like I would rather my phone just completely either log out of the app or close down the app or do something to where I don't have this tiny little easy choice just to click a button and say, no, thank you. I'm actually going to ignore my time limit now.
My main thing that I wish that the iPad had was dinner time mode, which was like a button that parents can push that literally shuts the thing down. There's no just like button that I can push to turn the internet off in my house, that it's illegal to have a cell phone jammer in your house. So you can't even like make the internet go away if you want to in a building in the United States.
I went to Nepal a few years ago in 2018, and, you know, we're doing this big trek in the Annapurna region, and all of these tiny tea houses up in the middle of nowhere have Wi-Fi, and you pay like $2 for Wi-Fi or something. And it was shocking to me. I remember thinking like, it's everywhere.
There is something to this, right? I mean, Featherpipe is one of these places. I'm the chairman of the Esalen Institute. And we just got internet this year that's fast enough that doesn't feel like a 2400 baud modem or something. And people are begging us to get rid of it.
Yeah, we need to have ways to escape it. And like I said, not have that choice to even engage, like fully get away from it sometimes.
It's this really interesting problem. So there's sort of a combination. There's like individual skills, which I think that we don't need to get into super in depth today. It's like skills of the ages, they're ancient wisdom and meditation, awareness, yoga, somatic awareness, right? Like the ability to understand when you're reacting versus intentional about your actions and applying that to your individual technology use and your being a parent or in your workplace.
And really building that in to our lives so that we are using these things as tools. I mean, I know when you work with founders, you say, get a coach / therapist, like somebody to help you through this, and prioritize yoga, prioritize meditation, some of these self-awareness techniques, social time with your family, with your loved ones outside of technology.
Yeah, I think it comes back to the point that I was making earlier around be on offense, not defense. I always say this to entrepreneurs that I work with, design your life first and then let the company eat the rest of it. Building a new company or a new family, any of it, like being a parent, all available time will be taken. Design the balance into your actual schedule, right? If you're married, make sure you're doing date nights once, twice a week. If you're a parent, make sure you're taking time for yourself, probably every day, whatever your workout is. Make sure that you're prioritizing when you're going to eat. You know, there's just like all these things that are part of living a holistically healthy life that the internet will consume all of it if you don't design in the stuff that's healthy first. That applies to whether you're being a founder or entrepreneur or just, you know, trying to live a more healthy life, right? And then I think that how to think about society and what we should be demanding of our leaders, thinking about better rules and laws around what drives these systems. I think one of the things people don't realize is that your brain has no chance. Facebook is a 10 million computer computer. There are 10 million computers and data centers around the world that run Google and run Facebook. I think Google is actually 100 million computers now. And your one brain has no chance against these mega computers that are like incredibly smart. The whole fundamental problem of the internet right now is that we haven't discovered a business model that is a humane business model. Internet's been around for 29 years since I was a child when Mosaic launched and I was playing with Mosaic in my grandfather's room. And the dream has always been this utopia where everybody can publish and everybody can find a community. You can find the 1,000 people that are into what you're into. And that's like, I think the thing that I've always loved the most about the internet, because when I was a kid in that room in Montana, I could find other ski racers. I could find people that were into the music that I like. I could find other kids with ADD. I didn't feel so alone. Those are the great things about the internet. But the problem is, up until this point, we haven't discovered a business model that's not advertising.
Yeah.
Because of advertising, when you have a 10 million person computer at the center of a billion people using a system, the system will always be smarter than any individual one person, because it can see, if you think of it, it's very simple. The computer knows what everyone is doing. There's an asymmetry. It's like the computer is just smarter than any one person.
Mm-hmm. What are you working on in this realm right now? I know you have your hands in a lot of different ventures, in for-profit businesses, angel investing, and also with your nonprofit Sunrise. Can you just lay out some of the places that your energy is going towards making the internet a healthier place to be?
A lot what I'm working on right now is what we've been calling Web3 in the internet world, which comes on the heels of this crypto revolution that happened over the last 10 years. And largely most people didn't understand, and that's good because a lot of it didn't matter to what's going on now, other than that it evolved things to the point where now there's this new business model, which is putting people and the creatives that create all the content that you consume on the internet back at the center of the equation in a way that balances out the power between these incredibly centralized, massive computers run by a very small number of companies and the people who are actually the creatives making, you know, everything that makes the internet so fun. And so that's one of the things I'm really passionate about right now, is trying to help the next phase of the internet happen so that we can have a healthier internet that aligns these powers better. You know, the other thing that I'm spending an enormous amount of time on is, you know, I started this foundation in 2015 called Sunrise. We fund a lot of neuroscience and research into mental illness, and particularly around depression and neurodivergent brain types and how to reduce suffering, and fund technology that is in that vein. So most of my life's work and passion, whether it's on the for-profit side, investing in companies, helping founders, or my nonprofit work, all of it is focused on reducing suffering from these brain health-related problems and helping people come back to balance and then maybe find their potential as well.
Mm-hmm. Is it as clear to you as it is clear to me that a lot of the things that you are involved in today are such a direct result of your own experiences? You talked about a couple of these periods of your life where you're wanting to belong, you're battling anxiety and depression, and as we all grow and live and be humans, this is all part of it. And then here you are using your businesses and companies and organizations to directly impact other human beings.
I've loved the internet for my whole life because of this sense that no matter who you are, what type of brain, what type of sexual preferences or gender or whatever you think makes you weird, you can find your tribe, you can belong. And I learned that from a very young age in Montana, and working on all of this has been extraordinary. But I think that I feel a great sense of responsibility, because much of the ideas that we had in the early days of the internet, when we were authoring a lot of the stuff that now is at such large scale, there were no bad intentions. But I think that there's a lot of suffering that's been increased by social media in particular, and that we have a real responsibility to improve the health of it. It's possible for both of those things to be true. I don't even think that we would be sitting here having this conversation as directly as we are about depression, anxiety, ADD, if it weren't for podcasts, for social media. I think it would have probably taken decades longer for this to become normal to talk about. I mean, even when I first started Sunrise in 2015, it was like still like stigmatized to be talking about this stuff. I wouldn't just do it on a podcast.
Absolutely.
Now it's like embedded in culture. And I think we do have social media to thank for that. Mm-hmm. Watching the way social media has impacted the Ukraine war, you know, the ability for citizens to be eyes and ears and be part of how the whole thing is playing out. You could make the argument that the scale of the global response wouldn't have been possible were it not for social media. The sheer number of countries and citizens all over the world, that's a new phenomenon. And I think we as a society should be proud that we, humanity, created these systems to do this. But at the same time, it can also be true that we're dealing with, before the pandemic started, depression was already the number one. It was on its way to be the number one cause of death and disability by 2030. The pandemic, we don't even have the numbers yet, but has dramatically accelerated that. We now sit in the pandemic of the pandemic, which is the mental health crisis, which this thing caused and is still causing. Yeah. We've got to move things forward. There hasn't been a new antidepressant invented in over 30 years. Mm-hmm. It's a good thing that meditation apps are now one of the largest categories in the app store.
Yeah, I believe that.
That's great. But you know what? They still don't retain people very well. People buy them, they try them. It's only a month, you know, so we've still got a long way to go getting people more tools to access ancient wisdom, let alone new technology. So I kind of think of it that way, that a lot of the thrust of the work right now is how do you get people aware of ancient tools that can help them with these modern afflictions that are, you know, the suffering brought about by the double-edged sword of that social media can make me feel like I belong, but it can also make me deeply discluded and feel like I don't belong. It's a really fascinating thing. Like, it does both. People need to have these ancient tools in order to operate in this modern information environment.
I think that's a good place to begin to wrap up. And, you know, in line with all of this, the tagline of our podcast is the magic of living a connected life. And I'm curious of what it means to you to live a connected life.
I'm fascinated by the concept of synchronicity. Maybe we'll have to do another podcast on this sometime, but that when we set an intention in our lives or a goal, frequently you start to have these coincidences happen. I always say it's like when you are thinking about buying a new car, suddenly you see that car everywhere.
Yep.
I think this is one of the secret truths. If you have a goal and you're seeing confirmation of that through interesting synchronicities, like you're asking yourself every day, like, is it all connected? And you're following good energy. And that's what being connected to, like, you know, the universe, the stream, that's what it's about.
Dave Morin, an honorable and brilliant man with a deep love for his home state of Montana, as well as a strong commitment to how we as a society can live better, healthier lives alongside technology. One of the many takeaways from this conversation for me was the reminder to build our lives first, prioritizing what and who are important to us, then finding ways for technology to serve those priorities rather than the other way around. And if someone at the center of the tech industry is advising time away from devices and to lean on the ancient practices of yoga, meditation, and awareness, it's probably a good idea. Dave's personal life path was so inspiring, and I'm feeling incredibly thankful for his candidness in this conversation, especially surrounding his ups and downs and experiences with depression and anxiety. To learn more about Dave's work, visit sunrise.bio and offline.vc. If you've enjoyed this episode, you may also like episode number 5, Redefining Our Understanding of Mental Health with Matt Kuntz, another person in Helena, Montana, who is on the forefront of helping people with mental health issues and spreading awareness about these experiences that we all go through. A special thank you to Matthew Marsalek and the Drum Brothers, whose music you hear at the beginning and end of this podcast, as well as Dr. Jean Shinoda Bolin, who first turned us on to the phenomenon of the dandelion effect and how ideas move through the world. This podcast is a production of the Feathered Pipe Foundation, a 501c3 dedicated to healing, education, community, and empowerment. Please donate to this project by visiting featherpipe.com/gratitude and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Be sure to tune in to our next episode in 2 weeks. I can't wait to share another amazing conversation with you. Until then, have a beautiful day.